Good evening. My name is Marissa Levine. I'm the director of InForum here at the Commonwealth Club. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program with Ellen R. Malcolm, founder of Emily's List, especially during this election season. Now, if you're new to InForum or the Commonwealth Club, the video that you just saw gives you a great window into the types of programs that we produce here at the club. InForum itself has hosted everyone from Sheryl Sandberg to Tlaib Kweli to Senator Cory Booker. And we actually really like to think that you'll always leave our events having both learned something and met someone new. So look around, make a new friend, and start thinking about questions, because we'll be coming to you at the end of the program. I like that. Good. Good. Now, did you know that the Commonwealth Club hosts more than 400 programs a year? And we can only do that through the support of members, donors, volunteers, and those of you in the room tonight. So if you're thinking about getting involved, we would love to have you. Please see a staff member on the way out to learn about getting more involved. Sneak peek at some more of the programs coming up this spring. On March 22nd, we're hosting Breakthrough, a panel around connecting key innovations in technology to public sector challenges. On March 31st, Shannon Watts of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America joins us. On April 13th, we'll switch venues, head over to the historic Castro Theater for a conversation around criminal justice reform with Cut 50's Van Jones and author Shaka Sengor. On May 1st, we are hosting the Chief Data Scientist of the United States. If you didn't know we have one, we do, and he's fantastic. On May 26th, we'll be back here hosting Jessica Herron, CEO of Stella and Dot, on her book tour. And we're always adding new things to the schedule, so sign up for the mailing list. Get your tickets today. We do sell out, as you can tell. Now, following tonight's program, the book signing will take place over in the fireside room down the hall. We do have some books left, although they've been very popular, and they may even sell out our stash here tonight. So if you can't get one tonight, find one on Amazon. Now, InForum loves social media. I will not tell you to put your phones away. I will just tell you to turn the ringers off. You can find us on Facebook and on Instagram and on Twitter. We are always InForumSF, and that's our hashtag as well. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce both of the women who will be up here on stage tonight. We have our moderator, Christine Bronstein, who is an author and the founder of Nothing But Truth Publishing and A Band of Women, and who you are all here to see tonight, Ellen R. Malcolm, the founder of Emily's List.
Plugged.
Are we live? Hello.
It's an exciting night to be doing this. Yes, and I have a feeling a lot of people know about Emily's List and how much we have to be grateful for you for, but for those of us, those in the audience who haven't read the book yet, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how much you've raised and how many women you have put in office through Emily's List.
Well, I have to begin by going back to what it was like in 1985 when we began, when there were virtually no women in top offices. There were 12 Democratic women in the United States House of Representatives. That had gone down from 14 in the early 70s, so 15 years of the women's movement. We'd actually lost two seats in the House. Since that time, we've added 110 Democratic women to the House of Representatives. Yep. And there'd never been a governor of a large state. We had some Democratic women elected governor, not very many, but we've added 11 women governors, including the incomparable Ann Richards of Texas. But the thing that got us going, that made us furious, that frustrated us and energized us, that we had never been able to elect a Democratic woman to the United States Senate in her own right. 1986, our first election, Barbara Mikulski, our first candidate, became the first woman. And in total, we've helped 19 Democratic women go to the United States Senate, including Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. So little old Emily that was frustrated and angry said, if we could create a community of people that wanted to help pro-choice Democratic women, and we gave you all the information about who you are, we could raise enough early money to make them credible, we could help them go through the entire campaign, and we could create history, and we have done it time and time again.
Yes, and has raised over $400 million. That is
kind
some early money.
Yeah, that is early money.
And are there other groups that are out there that are focused on winning elections?
There really aren't. We're a very unique kind of organization, and it's one of the things, it took me years to kind of appreciate how odd Emily's List is. You know, in the political world, the funding comes a lot, not just from individuals, but from political action committees, PACs. And PACs are created primarily by organizations that have a legislative agenda. And their goal is to raise as much money as possible. They dole it out, and they try to get votes and make friends on Capitol Hill. So they want 51 senators who believe in what their agenda is and like them, and will meet with them and talk. And same thing in the House, 218 people in the House. So they divvy up all their money, and they essentially are trying to make friendships. Now, they don't really care about winning elections and what it takes to win elections. They just want the connections. And so heavily they invest in incumbents. It's why it's almost impossible to defeat incumbents. Well, we want to do all kinds of things that were different. First of all, we knew we weren't going to have a lot of races. We didn't have a legislative agenda. We wanted to be able to elect a smaller number of women. So we reinvented political fundraising. And we said, what we'll do is create a donor network where you join Emily's List, and we are kind of like your political staff, and we'll go find pro-choice Democratic women who have a chance of winning. We'll tell you about who they are, what they stand for, what's going on in their races, and we'll ask you to write checks to whoever you want. So if 1,000 people make out a check to Barbara Mikulski for Senate, write a $100 check and send it back to us, we can raise $100,000 as opposed to the 5 or 10 we can give as a PAC. So huge leverage on these races. And then, of course, as we grew, we started doing more and more things to help women understand how to build campaigns, how to mobilize women voters, and how to win elections.
Yeah, and the growth is incredible. But if I think back when I was reading your book, in 200 years, no woman had ever been elected in her own right to the
Democratic
Senate.
Democratic woman.
Democratic woman. And you have this idea that this is what you're going to do.
Right.
So you thought of something that no one else had ever thought of.
Well, some people had done, the Council for a Livable World had a sort of a donor network
right.
concept, but nobody had ever really taken it and made it work like Emily's List.
And you came up sort of, you weren't political growing up.
No. Nope.
And I wore pants for you because that was your first political
right.
win.
It was. In college, I went to a women's college in Virginia, and we were not allowed to wear pants to class or to dinner. So every day we'd have to change and put on our skirts to go over to the dining room to have dinner. And as my first political activity as a campus activist, I went to the president of the college, and I, this is in 1969 I graduated, so it's in the heyday of student unrest and people taking over administration buildings and all these terrible things, and here's little old proper preppy me. I think the president of the college was terrified. So I thought, well, I'm going to invite him to come to dinner to the dining room. And I don't think he'd ever had a meal in the dining room with all the students. He was a nervous wreck. And I, of course, then began to lobby him. And sure enough, before you knew it, he said, okay, I'll change the rules. You can wear pants to class and to the dining room. So it just shows what total intimidation and a good pair of jeans can do for a person.
And in chapter 3 starts with a great old quote. There are two things that are important in politics. The first one is money, and I forget what the second one is.
Yeah.
I'm at as 100 years old, right? I think right. that quote. Early money is key for any election. And why is that the stubborn key? Why is that the thing that
Well,
has
why don't
stayed?
I tell you about Barbara Mikulski's race? Because it's such a, it's like a little case study of
yeah,
why
and she bookends Emily's list.
Yeah,
right now,
she
so
does.
She's perfect.
And just a marvelous, marvelous woman and has done an incredible job in the Senate. But let me talk to you about how we got her there. Now, first of all, you should know, if you have an image of what a United States senator should be, you know, this tall, handsome man with silver hair, you know, Barbara's 4'10", a little stout, her hair is kind of going every which way. She comes from an ethnic neighborhood in Fells Point in Baltimore. She came into politics, she was a social worker, and they were going to put a highway through the community, and she basically organized everybody and stopped the building of the highway. They then elected her to the city council. She went to the House of Representatives for 10 years, and was ready when her United States Senator retired to make a run for the United States Senate. So Barbara, you know, not your prototypical Senate candidate, gets out there, and the same thing happens to her that we'd heard from women all over the place. First poll comes out, and Barbara is double-digit lead on her opponents. She is from Baltimore, and she is running against a Congressman Mike Barnes from Montgomery County. Great guy, wealthy part of the state. And then the governor of Maryland, also a Democrat, but he was having some trouble with a savings and loan scandal. So it really was not, he was not going to be a factor in this. So Barbara goes to the funders and she says, well, I've been in the House for 10 years. I'm ready to move up to the Senate. I am strong in the polls. Look at this Baltimore Sun poll. I have a double-digit lead. Will you make a contribution? And the guy said, no, you're not going to be able to raise any money. And because of that, we're going to support Mike Barnes because he's going to raise all the money from Montgomery County. And it's you just have name recognition. And when he goes up on television, you're going to lose. So the Mikulski campaign, chaired by a campaign manager, was Wendy Sherman, called me on the phone. And she said, all right, here's what we're going to do. Everybody in the campaign of our little tiny staff of a handful of people, one of whom, by the way, was Martin O'Malley, who is her field director, we're going to do nothing but raise money, and we want you to go out to Emily's List and start raising money for us. Now, we're brand new. We have 3 million members today. When we did our first candidate mailing for Barbara Mikulski, we had 600 members. And we were created this new thing that was like totally different. And so we really didn't know, were people going to make out the checks to the candidates? Were they actually going to send them back to us? We were supporting two women, Barbara and Harriet Woods. Would they ever all the money go to one and not the other? Or would people, in fact, write two checks to two candidates at the same time? So we sent out our mailing, and we just prayed this was going to work.
Well, and Barbara put you on the spot. She's like, I got you down for $100,000.
I know. So I thought I better get out there and get to work because I don't know what, you know, she thinks I'm going to do this. So we send out the mailing. We start praying, and the returns start coming back from the mail. Within 3 weeks, we had raised almost $30,000 for Harriet and $30,000 for Barbara. We had raised more than four times what a PAC could have contributed. So we were off. My goodness, the thing worked. We were beyond excited, as you can imagine. So the Mikulski campaign kept raising money. We kept working with our members. And when the first public filing came out, lo and behold, Barbara Mikulski raised significantly more than Mike Barnes. Now, here's what happens in politics. It's the funniest damn thing, I tell you. Mike Barnes' money all of a sudden just dried up, stopped. Like he could have just slammed the door. He ended up running out of money practically by the time we got to the primary. Barbara, who had this beloved base in Baltimore that was giving her this double-digit lead just went on from there, and she ended up beating him by more than 30 points to become the nominee and the first Democratic woman senator in the Senate. So for the first time, this early money that had been such a problem for women, we now had a way to make it work for women. And that, of course, is why we have our wonderful name, Emily. Early money is like yeast. We made the dough rise.
Makes the dough
rise. And it
rise.
Just kept on rising.
Yeah, I love. I didn't realize that that was the name until I read
it
the book.
Is.
I felt.
Often
felt like
I just say to the
that.
Audience, who's going to do it with me? Because I know there are members in this audience. What does Emily stand for? Early money is like yeast. There you go. The congresswomen, when I would tell them this in the beginning and they go out and they do talks and I'd hear these reports that, you know, Congresswoman Kennelly spoke to us today and she was so excited. She said, there's this new organization called Emily's List. It stands for, money, easy money. Like, no,
something
early money is like yeast.
Yeah. So you had that win and then 88 was less interesting.
Oh, no.
No?
Not to me.
Oh.
Not to me. Remember I said there had been a decline of Democratic women from 14 to 12? In 1988, we only elected two Democratic women, but since I'm one of the best lemonade makers you've ever met...
Way to read the book.
We reversed lemonade. The decline of Democratic women in the House in 1988.
So, yes, right. But there weren't any senatorial. You weren't backing any.
There were no senatorial candidates.
Yeah. And then 1992 was the year of the woman.
Wait, we forgot 1990.
Oh, 1990.
Oh, well, you know, it was elected governor in 1990, Ann Richards.
Okay.
We were the biggest funder of her primary race. And raised a ton of money of her when she was going down to the polls against that awful Clady Williams. We stuck with her and she came back and it was electric. And I want to stop and say one of the things we did, and I started working with a wonderful woman named Judy Cantor, who is sitting here. And, Judy helped us build Emily's List in the Bay Area, and we went down together to Texas. And when Ann was sworn in, she said to everybody during the campaign, we are going to move up, we are going to march up Congress Street and take back the Capitol for the people of Texas. So when we went into this to see her sworn in, there was a woman's event in a big office building, and she came up the street with this huge march of people marching up the street to take back the Capitol. It got to the building where all the women leaders from all over the country were and stopped the parade and invited all the women leaders to lead the parade to take back the government.
Yeah, there are some crazy stories in the book about the Ann Richards, the whole rise. Is it true that the man she was running against said that the year he didn't pay taxes, the economy crashed, and then he tried to take all people to Mexico and get them drunk so that they wouldn't write about it.
They wouldn't report it. So you read it. We have all kinds of great inside stories.
There's a lot of great stories.
You remember when she gave that great speech at the convention and she said, George Bush, he can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
And Ginger Rogers.
Yes. Does everything Fred Astaire does, only backwards. And as Anne would say, and in high heels. Well, in the book, you're going to find out what happens when Ann goes back to Texas, and the political Democratic establishment in Texas is not so sure they like the idea that this woman is going to be, you know, in charge of who pays attention to Democrats in Texas. So you'll get a lot of inside stories about some really wonderful people like that.
And I thought, my husband and I, we watch politics like most people watch sports. So to me, it was like page turner. Like, I could not put it down. But there were years that weren't big wins.
There were. Yeah, and after 90 and Ann Richards, Now, you got to understand, we're like the little engine that could, right? I mean, we have, going into 1992, after Ann's win, we had about 3,000 members. I think we'd raised about $1.5 million. We had a staff of about 7 people. And we knew that there were going to be some open seats in 92 after redistricting, and we were hoping we could elect more women. And so we were chugging along, just building the list, telling more and more people about Emily's List, and then the roof blew off.
With Anita.
President Bush nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. So you're going to love this book. You're going to remember all these things.
Well, and the movie's coming out in a month
and
with
Kerry
Washington.
So I always do a pop quiz at this point. The Judiciary Committee knew that Anita Hill had made this charge that Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her. And they tried to sweep it under the rug. Who was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee that tried to keep it a secret? Oh, you guys are good.
Joe Biden.
Vice President Joe Biden was chair of the Judiciary Committee during the Thomas Hill hearings. And Nita Totenberg made the story public, and they all of a sudden had to deal with it. You remember the 7 congresswomen with Barbara Boxer leading the way, marching over to the Senate saying, you've got to deal with this, you have to listen to this woman. And we were riveted because nobody really had talked about sexual harassment. It was the dirty little secret of the workplace. Women tried to cope with all this Mad Men kind of television show behavior, and it never really was anything you could bring up because you'd lose your job and you'd be in big trouble. So women all of a sudden watch 14 white men on the Senate Judiciary Committee basically either sit on their hands and do nothing to defend Anita Hill or essentially just trash her. And women were furious, and they started saying, where are the women? Why aren't there any women? And so they basically rose up and said, we are going to elect women into the Senate. There were 2 women in the United States Senate out of 100 members at that time, Barbara, of course, Mikulski, and Nancy Kassebaum, Republican senator from Kansas. And your Dianne Feinstein had one of the greatest lines of the Year of the Woman. She said, 2% is great for low-fat milk, but not for a representative democracy. So Emily's List took off, and Judy and I were running all over the place, and 60 Minutes covered us. And by the end of the election, we had multiplied the membership 7-fold. Raised $10 million. We then elected in that one election 4 Democratic women to the United States Senate and 20 Democratic women, new Democratic women to the House. So it was crazy.
And I loved the part in the book where you're like, okay, they have to stop calling and saying the senator is on the line. We have to get more women senators.
Right.
So I don't know who this is every time they call. And then you got that big win. And then the tides turned in 94.
94, we ended up having a very bad election. Remember, it was after health care reform. People were very unhappy that things hadn't changed. Your Dianne Feinstein was up for re-election because she had the little short term the end of Pete Wilson's term. It was a very complicated situation. She had to run again in 94, and she ran against Michael Huffington. Oh yeah, who was married to Arianna Huffington? Okay, you guys are going to be good. You should have written this book. And so Dianne was running against Michael Huffington. Dianne was the most popular political figure in California, and Michael Huffington had never done one darn thing in the House. He bought his House seat, and he basically announced he was going to spend $30 million of his own money going after Dianne Feinstein. And they went up with an ad that Ed Rollins had put together for Huffington. And it said it was essentially about by a Diane intervening to help a Raytheon get this small little thing taken care of, that Michael Huffington, their congressman, refused to lift a finger to help him. And it was either that or they were going to have to shut down a plant in his district. But he didn't want to bother doing anything, so she fixed it. And some of the officers of Raytheon made her a contribution. So this ad tells this story, and it says, Dianne Feinstein is just a special interest jukebox. Put in your money and get your favor. And I looked at that ad, and I called Mary Beth Cahill, who was our executive director, and I said, oh, my God, do we have a problem here. And you may recall, it was he was spending money left and right. Dianne's numbers were going down and down and down. And we had an idea that if we could reach women voters and bring them to the polls in what is now a non-presidential election where turnout always drops, it would help Dianne, and Kathleen Brown was running for governor. We could help our Democrats win, but certainly Dianne. And so we took our training director and sent her out. She started working for the California Democratic Party, and we created the first Women Vote program. And we targeted about 950,000 women who had no history of voting in a non-presidential election. They were either newly registered or they voted in previous presidential one, but then they stayed home, and we thought, you know. So basically no expectation that these women are going to vote. And we started doing a program with mail and tried to encourage them to do vote by mail, which Democrats never did in those days. And when we got the numbers, they were so unbelievable, we thought they'd made a mistake. We literally said, go back and run this again. We targeted 950,000 people. More than 425,000 of these women voted in the election, and Dianne was reelected by 165,000 votes. So if those women had stayed home, we would have lost Dianne Feinstein in the United States Senate. That was the power of Women Vote. And so in 96, we took it nationally, and it became part of what is now a very expanded political program. We do all kinds of things to help our women candidates. We give them a lot of assistance in putting their campaign together. We mobilize women voters. We train people to work in campaigns. So we're now a full-service political organization. But the biggest and most powerful part of it is Women Vote, and it started right here in California with Dianne's race in 1994.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And I remember... I remember one other piece from your book that you said the Chronicle helped with that. They reported about Huffington.
They did. Everybody was. But, you know, it's sort of like Donald Trump. I mean, it's, well, you know, people don't read the paper, don't pay attention. They see the ads, and the ads have the impact. And it was absolutely like tight as could be until Election Day. In fact, it was the absentee ballots. This was highly unusual for Democrats that turned it around for Dianne.
And how big is the women vote now?
Oh, now we spend tens of millions of dollars on mobilizing women voters. And it's a wonderful thing. As we built this political program, Emily's List now, obviously our goal is to elect our pro-choice Democratic women. But a lot of the things we do help Democratic men as well. And Women Vote is the best example of that, because if we can encourage someone to go out and vote, let's say 94 they go out and vote for Dianne, they don't just turn around and walk out of the voting booth. So they start going all the way down the ticket. And so if we can get those women out there and convinced to vote for Democratic candidates, it helps Democratic men and women win. So it's a wonderful way to give back to the whole ticket and the whole party in a state.
And as it was growing, you started to have to make some tough choices, because you have more and more women running. You have to make some hard choices, like Carol Mosley Braun, who mm-hmm. didn't seem like she had a campaign at first, even though she had Tony Podesta working for her.
She did not have a campaign. It's not that she didn't seem to have a campaign. Carol did not have a campaign. You want me to tell you the story, Carol?
Yes.
You're not going to read the book if I keep telling you all these stories.
Well, she's the only African-American woman senator, right?
We're going to change that this year in California, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so here's the story with Carol. It's the year of the woman. One of the people who voted to confirm Clarence Thomas was a Democratic senator from Illinois, Alan Dixon. He was running for re-election, and a trial lawyer in Illinois was determined to take him out, and he was going to spend millions of dollars against Alan Dixon. Meanwhile, Carol Moseley Braun, who is the recorder of deeds in Chicago, was angry about what had happened in the Thomas Hill hearings, and she said, I'm running for the Senate because Alan Dixon voted for Clarence Thomas, and, you know, never mind that, I'm running against him. So she runs, and she came to Washington, and we met with her, and I was actually out here, and our political director, Karen Johansson, met with her, and when I talked to her, she said, oh, my God, she's just the most wonderful woman. She's warm. She's smart. She's personable. But she has no campaign, and you know, she hasn't raised any money. She told me she had pledges. Well, any fundraiser knows that pledges doesn't mean money, right? Until you get the money, you don't have the money. So we said, well, we really love her, and she's great, but we have to only support viable candidates, so we better not get in. So there, you know, this campaign is going on, and the two men are killing each other on the airwaves. The trial lawyer is attacking Alan Dixon. Alan Dixon is fighting back against a trial lawyer, and Carol has no money. Nobody even knows she's there, and it's back and forth. And they start having the debates, and they get in the debates, and, you know, it must have been like the Republicans. So, one is attacking the other, and then back and forth, and you're the lousy scum, and no, you're worse, and all this stuff. Meanwhile, Carol gets up to speak, and she makes sense, and she's charming, and she has this incredible warm smile. And all of a sudden, people are like, I don't like those guys, but she seems kind of nice. And you could kind of feel that things were changing. So Gloria Steinem calls me at the office. She'd been in Illinois, and she was doing an event for Carol. And she said, Ellen, you really have got to get in behind this woman, Carol Moseley Braun. I said, well, Gloria, you know, we want to, but I don't think she's raised $100,000 yet. I mean, she just has nothing. No, there's really something going on here. Are you sure, Gloria? And she said, yeah. I said, all right. So I went back to Karen. I said, we've got to endorse her and make a contribution to her. It was way at the end. So lo and behold, we do. Primary night comes. The two guys nobody can stand either of them. And this woman who spent basically nothing in the Senate campaign defeated the incumbent Democratic senator in the Democratic primary. It was mind-boggling. And it just was like an explosion in the political world. Because all the energy from Thomas Hill hearings that we've been talking about since October, here's the first primary in March, and this woman beats a Democratic senator. What is going on? And that launched the political part of the Year of the Woman. And we went on from there. And in April in Pennsylvania, Lynn Yackel beat the lieutenant governor to run against Arlen Specter. And it just sort of going on from there, including Barbara Boxer. Nobody thought Barbara Boxer was going to win the primary. Mel Levine from Los Angeles had the support of the Berman machine down there. He had $4 million. Nobody thought Barbara Boxer was going to win. It was the Year of the Woman, and a lot of women turned out, and Barbara Boxer won the primary. So, but it all started with Carol, who, of course, went on and became the first African-American woman elected to the Senate.
I love that story. And so you're very careful about how you spend Emily's List money. So has the way that you choose to back candidates changed over the years, or has that pace stayed pretty steady?
It's pretty steady. It's our commitment to the members is that we support pro-choice Democratic women, and we support candidates who have a realistic chance of winning. We're going to send you candidates and ask you to write checks soon. We're not going to tell you about people that don't have a chance to win. We're not going to waste your money. We want you to invest in a place that makes sense. So we do a lot of work understanding what does it mean to be a viable candidate. Is this a realistic race? We look at polling. We look at what the campaign plan is. We talk to the candidate. What have you done? You know, are you making your fundraising calls? You know, you're running a good campaign. And when we decide that somebody has a chance and we then begin recommending that candidate to the members, we get them started, we raise some money, and just like good political venture capitalists, if they keep doing a good job, we keep mailing and keeping the money flowing in. Sometimes candidates just don't grow. You know, they had a chance, but, you know, and we tried to help them, but unfortunately they never really got off the ground, so we kind of let them go. When we see somebody that's in such good shape, they've done such a great job that they're a surefire win, we stop sending money there. So we're always, our goal is to elect the greatest number of Democratic women in any election. And so it becomes this constant process of kind of triage. And so by the end, we're just really making tough decisions about who's going to get that last little bit of money in October, you know. And so when you're a member of Emily's List and you understand this is what we're doing, you know, every time we tell you someone needs help, it's a good investment, and we're going to carry you through this process as sensible, well-informed venture capitalists that are going to maximize your return by electing the most Democratic women.
And I'm going to jump ahead to this election really quick, because there was a woman, Hispanic woman, Lucy Flores, in mm-hmm. Nevada, who Emily's List had backed before, mm-hmm. and is not the candidate that Emily's List is backing.
That's right. Now, in that case, there's more than one woman in the race. And you know, let me talk a little bit about that, because we knew that was going to happen. But in 92, it started out with a bang, with Jerry Ferraro and Elizabeth Holtzman running against each other in the Senate primary in New York. Liz Holtzman was a member of Congress during the impeachment trials of Richard Nixon, very smart lady, and gone back home. She ran for the Senate, failed at running for the Senate, and was involved in Manhattan politics. And, of course, Jerry was in the House and then was Fritz Mondale's running mate in 1984. So two powerful feminist icons, as well as two men. And that kind of set the stage for how we approach this issue. What we decided is that we had to look at these races and first of all decide, if we didn't choose between the women, would we lose the opportunity to elect a woman and the man would win? So, you know, did we have to make hard decisions? And then who was the stronger of the women candidates to win the general election? Because it's not about just winning the primary. Who can win the general election? And so in that case, we picked Jerry Ferraro. We did the same kind of equation recently here with Lucy Flores and Susan Lee, and essentially concluded that though we love Lucy Flores, she wasn't as strong in the campaign, and therefore, if we were going to elect a woman in that seat, we needed to come in for Lee in that race. So it's a tough decision. It often means not supporting women that we like. But at the end of the day, if there's one candidate that we think can win this race and we need to come in and make that happen, then we make those tough decisions.
And that must have been a really tough decision, because I know that you have an initiative to get more Latina women mm-hmm. into government that was also sort of put in place. So to have to make that choice.
Well, that's right. We are extremely committed to electing women of color, and in fact a third of the women we've elected to Congress have been women of color. It is a top priority for members. It is a top priority for Emily's List staff and board. And we are doing all kinds of different ways of outreach and trying to expand that effort. And we have a wonderful slate of candidates in this election. Catherine Cortez Namastow in Nevada, as an example, is running for Harry Reid's seat. And she could very easily become the first Latina elected to the United States Senate. So join Emily's List. We got a whole slew of candidates across the country. Tammy Duckworth in Illinois won her primary tonight.
I think, yeah, you're getting some good news in on some of these today,
I'm getting some good news.
Right?
We we won the primary nomination in North Carolina today for the Senate. And also for the top of the ticket. And we got two candidates running for the primaries in April, Donna Edwards for Mikulski's seat and Katie McGinnick in Pennsylvania. So we've got a whole crew of people, and I'm not going to go through them all because you can go to emilyslist.org and see them for yourself. And while you're there, grab your credit card.
And I'm can't wait to see all the finals from Super Tuesday, especially excited about the Hillary sweeping right now. But it's still at 20%, right, women?
It is. It's 18, I think.
Yeah, and so what are the other barriers? So Emily's List is helping them get money. What are the other barriers that are keeping it there?
Well, I'll tell you the biggest barrier to electing women. It's not gender. It's not what you think I would say, but it is not gender. It is the power of incumbency that makes it very difficult to bring newcomers into office. And there are very few opportunities, really, to add newcomers. And let me just do some sort of equations for you so you get a chance, so you get a sense of how we think about what we did. Not only in races, but how we develop the political program and the work we do. Typically, 95% of the members of Congress who run for re-election are re-elected. It's shocking. You think we have these big fights back and forth, Democrats versus Republicans. It's always over 90%. It is typically roughly 95%. Because of the way the congressional districts have been drawn to protect incumbents, there now are basically 200 solid Republican congressional districts and 200 Democratic districts and very little marginal districts in the middle. So when we look for places where Democratic women can win, all of a sudden those 200 Republican seats, for the most part, are off the table. So now we've gone from 435, you know, it's getting narrower and narrower. We can't beat the incumbents. And in any election, maybe there are 40 to 50 open seats. Well, by the time you get rid of the Republican districts, we're literally looking at 25 seats where maybe if we have a woman ready to run, we can begin on an even playing field. So it's not looking at 435 races. Once you narrow it down, it's looking at 25 or so. So what Emily's List has done is being very mindful of this. We have built a political program that takes advantage of every one of those opportunities we can find. And we do everything from recruiting and training women to run for the state legislature. So when one of those opportunities pops up, we know who's there and we can go recruit them. We've developed a whole way that we can help campaigns, such as doing this training, having people on our staff that work with candidates. And we mobilize women voters. We raise money. We do so much in those rare opportunities because there is not an opportunity to lose. And, you know, I could read a little bit from the book.
I know
from
Gwen
Moore.
You want
me to do that? You want me to read you a little snippet about a race like that? Because it's a great story. Gwen Moore is a wonderful woman, first African-American elected to Congress from Wisconsin. And this race that I'm going to talk about took place in 2004, And Gwen was running. She'd been in the state assembly. She had been in the state senate. And she represented the urban core of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Had very poor district, she was very beloved in her district, had this great grassroots following in her district. But to run for Congress, she needed to broaden her outreach. And because of redistricting, a lot of white working class Democrats have been added to the congressional district. So her congressman retires. And everybody's looking at this seat, and Gwen is looking at the seat. But, of course, the political establishment, just like Barbara Mikulski, has their guy. And his name is Matt Flynn. And he is a very successful lawyer in the community. He was the former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, getting the picture, the establishment's guy. He had the tacit support of the governor and the most powerful member of the congressional delegation, and all their people were sort of helping Matt Flynn. He was raising money like crazy. And so here, once again, we have our pro-choice Democratic woman trying to take on the establishment. And so let me tell you what happened when Gwen ran for Congress. Gwen had been trained by our POP program, which is our state legislative program, but she still had only a vague familiarity with Emily's List. For the most part, she dismissed us as a bunch of rich white ladies. I had heard of Emily's List, but I just knew they weren't going to help me. I heard they didn't help black people. But that was precisely where Gwen was wrong. In fact, that more than one-third of the women we helped elect were women of color, and we were exactly what Gwen needed if she was to expand her base. So we immediately assigned Jennifer Pelagia, a young staffer at Emily's List, to work with Gwen. At first, Gwen was standoffish. When Jen told her we would support her, she responded, "Oh, I know, you're the people that are going to make me swim across the English Channel, and when I get to the other side, you're there with warm towel and hot chocolate." Well, Jen told Gwen she was exactly what Emily's List was looking for, a committed pro-choice Democratic woman who would be an excellent member of Congress, and wait till she saw what we could do to help. Gwen was a fascinating candidate. In the state Senate, she had become a powerful voice who had real fire in her belly. She gave startlingly candid speeches on the floor of the State House, using her own life as an unwed mother and someone who had been assaulted as a child as an example. "This woman is fantastic," said Jen. "She's one of the smartest people I know. She has a photographic memory. She's crafty. When the community couldn't borrow any money, she went off and started a credit union. It was typical of the way Gwen thinks and acts. We should have it," so she did it. She was terrific on issues that were important to her district, such as food stamps and housing. The problem was that none of those issues brought in political money. I've never seen a candidate who had such a small potential fundraising base, and Gwen was almost proud of it. "One of her supporters gave her a box of pennies, and I saw Gwen literally counting the pennies," said Jen. She wanted to make the point that the contribution meant as much to her as all the hours spent raising money on the phone from white liberals. So suddenly you had an understated, mild-mannered young white woman from the Midwest, Jen, trying to tell this unstoppably powerful black woman what she needed to do. It wasn't easy. When it came to debating, Gwen's rhetoric was not exactly geared to the affluent white liberal donors she needed. As Gwen put it, her style was street. "I know how to argue, I know the facts, but before Emily, my style was something like this." To demonstrate, Gwen slowly took off her glasses and looked directly at me as if I were an opponent in a televised political debate. "Kiss my ass, mother trucker. I'm going to tell you how it is." And then she burst into laughter. Of course, Gwen was putting us on. She was much too smart to blow up her own campaign. But just in case, we made sure Gwen's rhetorical skills were refined somewhat by the time the election was over. Amazingly, it all began to work. Emily's List couldn't do the actual work of the campaigns, fundraising, organizing, and the like, but we had a continuing interest in assessing our races. Of course, a critical part of that process was advising staff, many of whom were new to their jobs, on what was working and what wasn't. So we sent staffers to monitor Gwen's field operations and her get-out-the-vote process, help her with debate prep, and raise money from progressive donors. In the end, we sent so many staffers from Emily's List that Gwen used to name Emily as a prefix for all of them. Emily Jen, Emily Dave, Emily Heather, and so forth. I was proud to be known as Emily Ellen. Gwen was a powerful and much-loved candidate, but it was also true that our relationship with her was a terrifically productive political marriage. In the last reporting period before the September primary, Gwen raised $354,000, four times as much as Matt Flynn, and more than $200,000 of that came from our members. In late August, Women Vote went on TV with an issue ad praising Gwen for her work on education. We are at her side every step in the way. When the votes came in on September 15th, Gwen earned her win in what can only be described as a colossal landslide, winning 64% of the vote to just 25% for Flynn. It was hard to remember that just a few months earlier, Flynn had been the prohibitive favorite. And that is the power of Emily's List.
And now we are going to be taking your questions. If you raise your hand, a staff member will come over to you and make sure it's a question, not a statement. And I also wanted to point out this graph that we blew up very quickly from the back of the book that shows where Emily List started. The bottom line is where the Republicans are as a percentage of women, and the top line shows exactly how much we have to be grateful for Emily's List in growing women in Democratic politics.
Today, Democratic women, yep. It's pretty amazing. Democratic women now are a third of the Democrats in Congress. We both started out at 5%, Republicans and Democrats. Republican women have gone from 5% to 9%. So in 30 years, they have made no progress of electing Republican women to Congress. It is a scandal.
Well, and if you hadn't started Emily's List,
that's right.
We could be in the same position right now.
That's right. So I said, first saw this graph, because I've been trying to get the staff to run these numbers for me, and they finally showed me the graph, I said, I want this on my tombstone. Be the only tombstone with a graph on it.
And the policies that your women have brought forth have changed our world for the better. So, questions.
Our first question is coming from Randy. Hi. How do you determine who you're going to fund?
I think I went through some of that about we support pro-choice Democratic women who have a realistic chance of winning, and then we give you information about them and the how do we find them? Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. You said, how do we fund them? Well, that's a very good question. And as we've broadened and done this state and local work, we have much better contacts in the community. In the old days, we had a network of people that we'd work with on ERA and the National Women's Political Caucus, and we could kind of reach out through them. Now we have a vast network. We talk to groups like Emerge and other organizations in the states that really have a sense of who's good in the community. We talk to women we've helped elect. We talk to our allies in labor and environmental organizations. We're like Diogenes with the,
and you
lantern.
Train. Don't you train?
And then we train them. So we're always looking for good women. And I should say, one of the things that we have found is that women are so self-effacing about running. I used to laugh, and I'd say, if you asked a man if he wanted to run for the Senate in his state, he'd probably say, no, I'm running for president. How dare you ask me for that? When we train women, they say, I've kind of thought about running for office, but nobody's ever really asked me.
Well,
so we spend a lot of time, and I'm going to do it right here tonight. If you care about your community and you're involved, I encourage you to run for office. We need more good people running for office.
A, Elizabeth Warren, right? It had to be. Elizabeth Warren was one of the women you all talked into.
Yeah, well, Elizabeth Warren is one of the people. Stephanie Shriok, our new president, now 5 years, so it's not that new, but our current president basically convinced Elizabeth Warren to go ahead and run for the Senate. And the other person that helped her was Senator Patty Murray. So thank goodness she did, because what a leader Elizabeth has become.
Yes. And I think of a question.
Hi, this is a great follow-up question. So what would be your biggest advice for a young woman who wants to run for office someday?
My first is think about it, and I'm glad you're thinking, I hope, about it, and making plans. I think you should get involved in your community and find out what the issues are that are happening there and how you can help, and really get a sense of how you can become a problem solver. And as you do that, you will then make a lot of contacts with people who eventually can become your support team and your political network when you decide to run for office. So it's not something you do right off the bat. You got to kind of make your... You have to get your political tentacles out there, learn a lot about what's happening with people and what they need and how you can help provide it, and, of course, how government can help. But at the end of the day, go for it. Don't be afraid. Be brave. You know, dare to win and go out and run. And Emily's List and organizations like Emerge will help you do that.
All right. We have our next question over here from Erica.
Thank you. So I love, obviously, everything that you've done at the federal level. I'm a little obsessed with the state level. We are currently at 16% Democratic women in the state legislature, so that's 19 people out of 140, and we're going to lose 6 of those people in November, no matter what. And so if you could tell, there's actually a few of us here that are really focusing on trying to figure out how do we change this. What would you tell a group of young politically enthusiastic young women to do to change that? Because we want to take this fight on for the
next
20 years.
Well, first of all, fabulous. Because,
thank you all.
All of you. Term limits have been devastating. I'm going to give you 2 sober facts about California. Term limits have been devastating for women in the legislature. And you are right. It has gone down to a very low level. And every election, it becomes more of a challenge to try to get women in. Now, here's the other sobering fact. You have so many Democratic women in the congressional delegation in this state. 8 of them are 70 years old or over. So it's going to be, over the next few years, a lot of our women and our gains are going to retire. So we need to have new women ready to run. We need more women in the legislature. There's an organization called California's List that I think is still working.
So California List is what we are now. It's California Women's List. And that's something that we just relaunched in September.
Well, good for you. Okay, so now how might someone support you if they might want to? Because I have a feeling there might be 1 or 2 people here that have, do they have a website?
We do have a website. It is californiawomenslist.org. There are 5 of us here tonight. We'd be happy to talk to you. We'll stand in the corner. But we really are the original founder from California List, really took this idea from Emily's List and has really tried to build it up in California. We now have relaunched it. Young women and men that want to just be the fundraising and political operation to then, because we love Emerge, love to close the gap, and want to do that next step.
All right, so where do we find you? Got that?
Yep.
Okay.
And early money is just as important for those races. Yes.
All right. So we need to talk afterwards. Yes. And do you know the Emily's List staff? Do you know Michelle Ortiz?
I don't know Michelle.
Stick with me, kid.
We have our next question from Sandra over here on stage right.
Good evening. And Emily's List candidate is Ambassador Suzanne Johnson Cook, running for the hotly contested race in New York, Charlie Rangel. While she is widely known in faith-based circles, what is your strategy to help navigate the waters and merge faith-based and non-religious groups that will support her?
Well, I'm not familiar with that race. I have to give a little truth in advertising here. I'm the chair of the board of Emily's List, but I'm not running the day-to-day and haven't for 5 years, so I'm a little, I don't know about all the details of every race. But I can tell you when we go into communities, and, you know, it goes back to that question, who do we consult? We reach out and try to involve a lot of different organizations in supporting the candidates. And it's very important to understand where the power of the community resides. And it changes from community to community. And we have a lot of people that become our ambassadors to sort of give us the lay of the land, which helps us understand the dynamics and how to help women. So good for you for knowing about that race and help.
All right, we have our next question from Carlo over here.
Hello, I'm Carlo. I'm the board president for Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you for coming tonight.
Okay.
Such a pleasure to have you here, having grown up with a single mother and two younger sisters, so I keep trying to get into politics. question for you. Given the current landscape, which three candidates do you think are going to be ready to take on the presidency after Hillary wins it?
Oh.
That's a good question.
Well, I like the way you put it. And I guess that means I have 8 years to sort of put it all together. So, you know, that's good. There are now a wonderful number of very talented women in the Senate and running for the governor and Congress. You've seen the senators, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand. You know, I think we're going to see a lot more women from the local level, and 8 years is a long time for people to pop up. So when we started, people say, well, do you care about electing a woman president? Well, yeah, but it was about the most unrealistic thing in the world. I mean, there were just no women ready to run. They were nobody prepared. And so one of the things we've done is really try to create a deep bench of Democratic women that are doing a very good job in their current positions and are ready to move up. And so, you know, I think Hillary has the same attitude as Barbara Mikulski had when she became the first woman to the Senate. She said, you know, I don't want to just be the first woman in the Senate. I want to be the first of many. And I think Hillary feels the same way.
But there is like a formula, right? So for if you were Democratic governor in a red state, or I think you talked about it in the book, right? So
no,
sort of a formula that feeds into the pipeline for presidential possibilities.
Oh, I think the places to look, the obvious places that we look are governors, senators. It's a big stretch for a congressperson, but it may be possible. People that have been in the administration and cabinet secretaries. It is unusual to see somebody like Donald Trump as a businessman do this well. Well, the whole thing is unusual, but I think there's lots of places to look, but the traditional path is more senator and governor.
We have a question from Zach. Over here on stage right.
Hi, good evening. So with the current generation being perhaps there's not as many causes like the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 70s, mm-hmm. and with the current political climate, how do you work and what's the plan for getting young men more involved in the pursuit of equal rights politically for women across the country? What's the plan to get young men more involved like me? Because I think mm-hmm. looking at things like Bernie Sanders and, you know, Hillary kind of has to be kind of forced down because I think she gets a little... You know, she gets criticized for bringing up things like women's issues. What's the plan moving forward for that?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that we've always had a good chunk of men as our membership, which I really appreciate. There are a lot of men that understand that our government would work better if there were more women in it, and they want to promote women, and we're very happy to have them. Right. I think... we as a country have really missed the boat on huge social changes that have taken place as women have entered the workforce. It's really shocking when you think about it. In the 30 years that I've been since we started Emily's List, women have entered the workforce. The whole pattern of balancing work and family has changed. What do we do with children as a result of those social changes? And we have done so little to really change and modify our policies and our support system to help men and women who are trying to raise families and make a decent living. And so one of the things that I find very interesting in this election, when you say that Hillary's talking about women's issues, she's actually talking a lot about issues that are economic development issues that have been shunted aside and really not been on the front burner. So as a woman, she's bringing them forward, but equal pay for equal work is a family issue. It's about having a decent income in the family. Paid family leave, paid sick leave. Those are family issues. As families try to grapple with how do we do this now with everybody in the workplace. And, you know, it's just, I think that younger people that are getting involved in politics, whether they're supporting Bernie or Hillary, are getting energized. I think it's fantastic because the younger generation is feeling these pressures all the time. And just as the early feminists started saying, wait a minute, it's not your fault that you're feeling that you're missing out and that people aren't respecting you. It's a societal issue. I think families that are struggling where there just isn't enough time in any way to manage work and make sure the kids are okay and be a good spouse and just put all those pieces together. It's not an individual's fault that they feel guilty and exhausted and think they aren't doing a good job. It's a societal problem. And I hope that the younger generations now start articulating that. When they do, there will be a new kind of women's movement. It may not just be women, but it will tackle a lot of the issues that women have been grappling with for decades.
And the ERA hasn't been ratified yet.
That is up to you all. I'm serious. That is not my job. And the reason I say that is I have had my life experience. And, you know, it goes back to this whole thing about millennials. You're not going to be me and I'm not going to be you. And you all that are experiencing this now, that understand the problems that you face now, have to begin to articulate political solutions to that. And it is when your generation starts rising up and saying, no, we've got to do things differently, that change will happen.
And I'm so grateful for everyone for coming. Oh.
I don't have the microphone.
We have one more question from the back. We have one more question right here from
Indigo.
Well,
there's lots of questions, yeah, Judy. It's not just him.
I think we're going to end, and we're going to have the last question is always the Inforum tradition, and we want to thank Inforum so much for putting this on, but they ask all their speakers, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Another one?
Uh-huh.
My 60-second idea to change the world is to create a representative democracy that truly represents all of us. And I think when women are more than half the population and only 18% of the Congress, it is not working. One of the reasons the Congress does not work is because there are not enough women in the room. And when women come in the room, they start finding solutions. They set priorities for a broader group of people that includes women and families. And they're smart as the devil. So if you want to make the Congress work and you want to see the country get moving, then I think we need to elect more women. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thanks. This was great.